green flag waving. We are ready to go here in Misano. Lights out and away we go. Not a good start from Maverick Vinales at all. Franco Morbidelli got away really well. Fabio Quartararo gets swallowed and through comes Jack Miller as well. It will be Morbidelli that leads from Rossi.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 644. I'm your host, Skyler Vergori, and joining me as ever is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going?
It's crazy. The world's crazy. Chaos is not only in MotoGP, it's also in Formula One. If you didn't see the Formula One race from Mugello, watch like the first 15 minutes or so. You'll understand why where the chaos has now been swept away to them. Work is hectic despite a pandemic. What else is going on? I don't know. I'm leaving for 7 days for a work trip. Hey, let's do a show too. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, it's been crazy around here. Outside of everything that's been going on, and then of course the fires are extremely bad out here this year.
Oh yeah,
to the point where we had these extremely dark orange skies for a better part of a week. It was really weird. Like, you had to have the lights on all day in the house. It was so dark. It was like being in an eclipse the whole time.
Ouch! That doesn't even sound funny at all.
No, and it was like the air quality was really poor outside. You didn't want to go outside. You could actually feel the burn in your lungs and in your nose. And this is just not our fires. I mean, Oregon's having a real tough time now too. And everything's kind of floating out to the into the Pacific Ocean. And it's got this north to south down with the wind coming down with the currents. And so it all floats onto the coast every once in a while. And it comes in like a big, thick fog. And so we'll just be covered in this stuff for days. And couple that with our own fires that we have going here, it's been pretty bad. I mean, it was like snowing ash at one point, and go out and draw your name on your car. So the world, wow. I think 2020, I think we can just go ahead and label the theme for the year is chaos, Jim.
Oh yes, I'm good with that.
Yeah, it has been a fun one. But you know, after a couple weeks off, which was much needed for the both of us, we are back to talk a little bit of motorcycle road racing here. And that is going to be from the Misano Grand Prix over in Italy. The first race, mind you, that had fans this year,
yes,
which is pretty impressive.
10,000 people.
And before we do that, we wouldn't be having this show here if it wasn't for the super cool donators that we do have on the show, such as Keith Kovac, Dick Sabin, Scott Saunter, and Alan Femi. Thank you very much for your kind donations. They help us keep the lights on around here and everything else. You all know the spiel. If you want to be like one of these cool folks that have donated to the show, you could do so by going to our page at motopodcast.com. Right there on the left-hand side, there'd be a donate button, a little PayPal link, you can click that. Or you can subscribe for as little as $2 a month. If PayPal's not your thing, we also have a Patreon site. That's patreon.com/motopod if you want to go over there. So just remember, any little penny helps, and it keeps the kind of show going. And this show goes completely into the nation, so we don't have to jump in here with any radio advertisements about manscaping or underwear.
Yes, no, not
or
that.
Any
I am
of
not
that
doing that
crap
ad.
You hear on all the other podcasts. We will never do that, so we can always just get right to the show.
Might hear about beer for a while, but that's okay.
Well, no. If we get sponsored by beer, I think I actually won't turn that one down. That just goes hand in hand with the show. That's not really a sponsorship. That's an enhancement, I would say.
Oh, it's gonna be a long one, folks. Buckle up.
Well, and you know the funny thing is, I don't have any beer today. Actually, as it is, I've been too busy to even go to the store.
Wow.
Ooh. Yeah, it's been that kind of week. Lots of overtime. Lots of new things at work, so you know how it goes. New releases, everybody works 12 hours a day.
That is true. Why don't we go to the news? How about that?
Let's do that.
Okay, so you had homework for me from the last time.
That's
because
right.
You had a theory about Marc Marquez, and the reason that he wasn't riding was because he had nerve damage in his arm. So mm-hmm. I had to ask my wife, who is a doctor. She's not a surgeon, she's just a pediatrician. So nerves and really high complicated bones and things. I mean, hey, if it's just a crack, she'll cast you up. But if it requires screws and plates and stuff like that, you got to go see an orthopedist. Anyway, I asked her, I said, do you think there's any validity to the fact that Marquez has nerve damage? So we kind of scrolled through his Instagram page. We looked at what he was doing in the time frame that was going through it. And her conclusion is that you are partially right. She thinks that by doing what he did, as soon as he did, he aggravated the nerve because of the swelling that was induced by the effort he was putting through that bone to hold a motorcycle, lift weights, do all the other stuff. So long story short, the swelling swelled up, pinched a nerve, and they had to control the swelling to get it to calm down. She equated it to, for people like me who are not doctor smart, that it was kind of like when somebody has carpal tunnel, they kind of go in there and they cut some of the silver skin on your muscles. She says it's kind of that idea, that you have that problem with the muscle and the bone and everything there, because the muscle now is trying to take up all the force that the bone would take up because the bone's trying to heal. So then consequently you swell and you've got limited blood flow through that area. Then it winds up pinching a nerve and then you can't really feel anything. So the only way you can get through it is to simply sit down, relax, not do a whole lot. And from the pictures it is now, it looks like Mark is starting to work out again with maybe a return at Aragon, possibly. So that's that part for the news, unless you got something else you want to add in there.
No, I just, you know, I don't find it shocking that you need a rest after you injure yourself.
Especially when you snap your humerus in half. I mean, it's the second largest bone in the body after your femur. Anyway, well, let's move on there. Now, see, Cal Crutchlow could not race at Mizano this past weekend because he had complications from arm pump surgery.
Oh, I got to jump in here because Cal, as we all know, is not a shy guy and posted up his pictures of when they had his arm open when they were doing the surgery.
Yeah.
If you want to know what the inside of your arm looks like, you can go ahead and head over to his Instagram page. But I tell you, it is not for the faint of heart. My goodness.
And supposedly he had like a hole in there that that was draining pus out of. And the idea was, hey, if you ride, you're going to sweat and you're going to get an infection in here. And this is going to get really, really bad. So he couldn't. So they said, don't ride. Like, oof. Okay. Right. Honda season just got worse because that left only Nakagami on a bike. Well, I guess Alex and
I can modify your statement.
That okay, thank you. Yeah, I probably needed that one. I've been off 2 weeks. Bike. I'm a little
let's
off.
Put it, let's put it that way, maybe. There we go.
Okay. More news. I knew it was going to have to happen sooner or later. Somebody would have to test positive for the novel coronavirus, a.k.a. COVID-19. And it was Jorge Martin who did. So he was not allowed to race at Mizano. Hopefully he'll be back for this weekend's race. If he follows the protocol, quarantines himself, and gets another couple of tests, and they come back negative, he'll be allowed back in, which we really need to get him back because there would be an amazing title fight if it isn't already a good title fight. So there for that one. Let's see. The Mizano circuit was repaved. However, it was extremely bumpy. Quartararo called it a motocross circuit. Why in the world this thing is bumpy? I got no idea. I mean, you put down brand new asphalt, generally it's going to be pretty smooth, but I don't know what's going on underneath of that. Now, if it was Texas, I could tell you the answer. It's because the ground moves, but this one I'm not sure about.
What I'm thinking here is a similar situation because geographically they're loaded pretty close to the ocean, right? And as we all know, most of the land near bodies of water tends to be a little softer in most cases, unless you're like lake mountains and things like that. So I'm wondering if they kind of got the same thing going on where they laid the asphalt, and it's also been extremely hot out that way too, that the temperature might have affected it as well. But then the ground, like you said, after they poured the asphalt on, it's starting to move around.
Yeah, I mean, who knows how they
did the American thing and went with the
grind it down first,
and
did they just go over top of it? You don't know exactly what happened, but yeah, I mean, if people complain about Texas and how bumpy it is, they are complaining probably just about as much with the bumps there. I mean, there were so many head shakes heading through the turn 11, the very fast kink in the backstretch, that it was one of those moments where every time you saw one, you just had to kind of hold your breath and go, because you're expecting the worst. So hopefully they fix that there in some way. More news. It's a silly season, so now we're starting to find out where people are going, who's riding, where and what and why. But Darren Binder is going to stay in Moto3. However, he's not going to be on the team that he's on. He's going to be on a different team, and I did not catch it and could not find anywhere in my notes where I wrote it down. Do you know where he's going? Because I do not remember. I don't remember who. Okay, yes.
Was it Snipers? I'm trying to remember. I saw it a while ago. Patronus Sprinta. So he's going to Patronus,
which is, I thought, in Moto3, as well as you did,
team,
that
I got to say I'm disappointed.
He is a much better suited person to be riding in Moto2. However, that has not panned out. We'll go down to Remy Gardner, who fractured his hand and his foot, and he was declared unfit to race. So I don't know if Remy's going to be able to ride next weekend. I haven't heard anything yet. Knowing him, he's going to give it a try. They all do. We'll see what happens. Bastianini will ride with Ducati next year in MotoGP. I'm thinking that he's got the Pramac seat for sure. We know Miller and Bagnaia are probably going to the factory itself, leaving two spots for that. You got to believe that Jorge Martin will partner Bastianini. I personally am shocked that Bastianini got that call up.
I don't understand that call. I mean,
I'm missing something, because there's two VR46 guys who probably should have that ride.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, you could always do the, like, well, you know, it's the Italian thing, but the VR46 guys. I mean Bezzecchi, maybe not Bezzecchi right now, because I think he's just hitting his stride in Moto2, and next year, you give him one more year, he could definitely wrap his hand on the championship. He might even do it this year. But Marini, I really thought that's where they were going to be kind of leaning towards.
Well, I thought so, too.
As far as bringing on. But Bastianini, he's had decent results, but I don't think he's ever been like, oh, man, this guy definitely has to be a call-up this year. Sure, work his way towards that. I mean, he's a front runner in Moto2, and he was definitely a handful to deal with in Moto3. But yeah, I did not see that coming. And of course, you know, rider coaches and everybody else that evaluates these guys definitely know more than we do when it comes to, you know, picking out talent. This just seems like a strange move.
It's almost as strange as Quartararo going from Moto2 to Patrona Sprinta, which, I mean, you know, I took the flyer on it, and you said, well, who would you put on the bike? I'm like, yeah, I'd throw Quartararo on there. You got to give him a shot, man. He's looked decent in at least a couple of races, and he's turned out to be a phenom. So I kind of almost maybe lucked into that one, but maybe Bastianini will do the same thing. I do not know. I don't think he will. I think he'll be good, but I don't think he is, you know, groundbreaking sort of. He might, you know, he might turn out to be like a, like your, I had it. I lost it. Who's the guy who rides with Quartararo on the team?
Morbidelli.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where it's just going to take him a little bit and get better kind of thing. Yeah. I've been off for 2 weeks. And again, we don't get paid. So, who had the beer tonight, huh?
Yeah, right. But yeah, no, it is a strange one, but we'll see. Have they confirmed that they're going to be doing Jorge Martin to Ducati?
Mm-hmm. Figure that's got to be Pramac. So there's your Pramac team settled.
So that leaves Odd Man Out, who thought he might be getting a factory seat and then maybe get a Pramac seat. But it looks like Zarco is going to be kind of staying where he's at.
Now he might get a better motorcycle.
This is true. He may get a better motorcycle. Yeah, because it's kind of one of those things. If you're Ducati and you know you have Zarco back there, right? You don't have to take a big run with him, but you give him his contract. If you give him a better bike, he works with that team. And if we've seen anything with Zarco, he needs to work with the team. If he doesn't, and he doesn't trust the team, and the team can't get his setup or deal with his moodiness or whatever it is, it all just falls apart. So they may not want to upset that. Maybe they're going to keep him where he's at and say, hey, here's this year's bike. It's all the same. We're still working with you. We send our guys down to your pit. Let's have five competitive bikes. Why not?
Sure. Why not? Remy Gardner makes news again. That just came out today. And for reference, we're doing it on Wednesday, the 16th of September. But Gardner has signed with Red Bull IO to ride in Moto2 for the 21 season. I do not know if it's any longer than that. I think it's a one-year deal, which is good for Remy. He'll be with a good team on a good bike, and hopefully we'll see some good results out of him.
Right. This is a double-edged sword for Remy, though, I think, too, right?
Ooh, if this doesn't work this time, he's not getting anything else.
There you go.
Again.
There you go. So the pressure's on. Yes, he's earned this spot. I think he should be on this team. But if you can't do it with these guys, now, of course, we'll have to see the bike he's on. Maybe the whole package is crap, and we'll have to reevaluate this next year. But, I mean, this is kind of one of those deals. Like, this is like a Mark Vidiesque, AO, or the Patronus. When you are on this bike, you are expected to do one thing and one thing only, and that's bring home a championship. So,
or at least contend for it.
Yes, yes. You've got to be a front runner. So we'll see. It's a great opportunity, and I think he's a great rider for that bike.
And the last bit of news, Tech 3 announced that Denis Anshu and Sasaki will form an unchanged rider lineup for the 21 Moto 3 season.
Good move.
I think that was what that was going to be. I think Hervé sees some real talent in Sasaki. I think that they also see some talent in Anshu. And they have been known to be able to groom people very well. I give you Dovizioso, I give you Cal, I give Zarco.
Spees.
Toseland, yes. The list goes on and on. You know, eventually, you know, you got to think, eventually at some point, Rossi's going to get Geeky Lam to tune his bike. I mean,
I don't know about all that.
He's kind of tuned for everybody but Rossi. But that is all of the news. So I'll let you go to the next section.
All right, so that brings us down into a little listener feedback that we got, and this is going to be some good stuff that we got, because last time me and Jim talked about turn marshals and corners and corner marshals and the safety crew and what we kind of thought should be going on, but we also had some gaps in our knowledge. But that's why we have great folks such as Simon, who wrote in from Brisbane, Australia. He goes, "Hi, just listened to your episode number 643. In particular, your comments that we need tech experts at each corner. For marshalling, we currently have sector leaders on each corner that manage a team radio and track marshals. I've been marshalling at Phillip Island MotoGP and World Superbike for the last 10 years. In the last few years, I've been a section leader, or sector leader. Sector leader also has their own radio loop to race control and is a key part of the role, as well as managing the whole team of about 10 to 15 people that are reporting everything that happens to race control, including whether a bike after running off the track is dirty, leaking oil, etc. Race control wants to know that information as soon as possible. For instance, I will be running to the incident and race control will be asking me, sector leader one left, can you please update us if bike is dirty or clean? Sector leader is a very dynamic role. The sector leader is a very dynamic role, and you are often managing inexperienced people to perform important roles to ensure people's safety. Sector leaders are carefully chosen with skills and experience. They also train regularly, brief us very well. I was a sector leader at Turn 1 at Phillip Island last year. The Saturday when the weather turned really bad was a big challenge, but we managed to ensure people's safety. In Australia, all the officials do a fantastic job to manage all the risks. It's dynamic, but it also runs like clockwork, no matter what the wild location and track at Phillip Island throws at us unexpectedly. Alrighty, so he goes, so if the incident that happened at Moto 3 in Austria with the dirty bike returning to the track was in Australia, the sector leader would be there to ensure that they were aware the bike was dirty, and if it was, they would report to the race control and stop the bike from returning to track. The track marshals should also be looking for oil too as they get the bike during recovery. Difficulty is if the bike is not leaking oil until after it returns track. Not likely, but possible. Race control and other points should see and report immediately. If they see any indication of smoke or leak oil, be waving a lack of adhesion flag straight away. Great job on your podcast. Listen to you guys every week. Cheers, Simon Keeman. Simon, thank you so much. That was a great write-in. It actually posed quite a bit of conversation on the email that we had. I think just about almost every host, past and present, jumped in on this one to talk and give ideas. And it just kind of shows you that there are people who listen to the podcast that are involved in all these different roles, and it is great to get these kind of write-ups in to explain a little further, you know, especially if me and Jim have never experienced something or we haven't done anything, to get these gaps of knowledge filled. So thank you so much, Simon. And Jim, I think you wanted to add to some of this.
Yeah. First of all, I want to be clear. I was not in any way trying to disrespect the corner workers in Austria.
Ditto.
Over that instance. That was not my intent. If I came across that way, that's my bad. Mea culpa, hand up in the air, I made a mistake. You'd think I'd understand how corner workers work and what they know and what they don't know, considering all the times that I've been helped by all the Weirer guys and all the CCS guys. So that was, it was great insight to know that there was actually a whole lot more to it than what I knew or thought that there was in it. But what was really cool was, again, all the hosts, past, present, have had jumped in with all these different ideas that came out about how things are going to be, how we could do things and make it safer for the riders. So initially, you know, it was, I'll give you this, it was a perfect storm. It was a bike that was in the gravel trap that at the time wasn't leaking any oil, but then started leaking oil once it started running and was, you know, a turn, a straightaway and a turn away from where the incident actually happened. So no one was really going to be able to actually predict that that was going to happen. But what we started really talking about was how can we warn riders of these situations or any danger situation, whether it's the Hoffe siren crash, whether it's oil on the track or whatever, what's a better way to warn the riders so we don't see things like the Fish's crash or things like that. So Simon had said in his that they want, that they have put lights in the curbing that are yellow warning lights, which are theirs that the riders could easily see because they're looking to an apex or they're looking for their brake marker nearby the curb. So it's very bright. They're able to see it. I think that's a really cool idea, a good way to put that in there. I thought that, hey, why don't we give them some sort of data via the dashboard in the motorcycle? So Martin came in and said, well, yeah, here's a picture of a dash. Here's where it says, you know, black flag. You could do something there. I was thinking it could be more like the turn indicators in your car that point with an arrow that either means you need to go that way or that's where the problem is. You need to go the other way. Maybe you can make that flash up in there. It kind of went back and forth from there again between everybody. I thought of, hey, could we borrow the idea of Formula One where they've got these big electronic flags? You know, it's about a meter by a meter square, maybe sized high intensity LED light that's shows you if it's reads like SC for safety car. It's got a green, all green for a green flag, red for a red flag, obviously. You know, do you have, you know, we could have a yellow flag that's in there that could be there. And I thought that'd be a really great way to kind of communicate with the guys. Then Lynn says, hey, they actually have those at Aragon, but you really can't see them when you're racing. It's like, whoa, okay, that's kind of, didn't think about that. You know, I figured with the intensity of those lights, you should be able to see it. But again, your attention generally isn't where it's focused. Now, as racing, you are not always able to see someone waving a yellow flag. I mean, these guys do an incredible job to try to wave as many flags as they possibly can and alert you to whatever is going on. But there are times when you are surprised by it. Like I had one day, I was coming out of turn one in a club race, and there's a corner worker running across the track to assist another guy whose bike had quit and was on the other side of the track. Now, I never saw that yellow flag, but what I did see was his bright orange gloves that the man was wearing who was running across the track with one hand pointing up and one hand pointing to the left to tell me to go by on that side. And then when he got to the other side of the track, he flipped them and went the other way around. And that was very easy to see, but it wasn't like I knew it before I got to the corner. I just couldn't see the flag. So I see Lynn's point. You couldn't see it. Even Matt Oxley made that point in an article in Motorsports Magazine today that they're great, but they're not necessarily where you can see them. So we kind of went down that road with that and then thought, you know, we could do something else maybe. But it was all great ideas that everybody had to try to figure out how do you make the racing safer than it is. And then now we just find out that at the test at Misano, they tested radio communications to riders from the organizer. Stefan Bradl tried it, and then on Tuesday, some other riders tried it. Rossi loves the idea of having a radio. If you can say that there is a accident in turn two, or there's oil on the track in turn four, if you can say avoid crash in turn five, something else that's going to come to you that you can have some way of recognizing that there is another problem to open your eyes, maybe take that little bit of attention away from racing a motorcycle, but racing a 300 odd horsepower motorcycle is always going to demand most of your attention. It's the great who can race it well because they've got that brain power left over to actually look for things, flags, debris, crashes, and all that. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the radios, whether we go forward with it, whether they have like taped things that just says accident turn 3 to accident turn 4. I don't know how quickly they could know, you know, obviously they have to get some communique from the great corner workers, to which then could be then broadcast to the other bikes. Maybe they also put this on the dash and say you have waving yellow flags on the dashboards of the bikes. But it looks like they're looking into doing something like this. And I think it was kind of great that the conversation kind of started with us and here, and we were talking about it, and then, hey, here comes this idea of bringing the radios back, which I'm sure they were working on long before we ever talked about it. But maybe the crash that Hoffe was in was one of those things like, hey, if we would have had this system, we could have told the riders to stay to the left exiting turn one, perhaps. And we wouldn't have had that horrific crash that we had. So it was great feedback. It was a great letter, Simon. Loved every minute of reading it. Loved conversing with you. So again, kudos to everybody who's ever worked a corner, whether it was from club all the way to the top pro races. Without any of you people, we couldn't be racing, so we couldn't be talking about what we love, which is racing. So I want to say a big thank you to everybody out there, and I hope that we have at least some of these ideas can be implemented and we can make racing as safe as we can make it.
No, it was fantastic, and the ideas that floated out was wonderful. I actually didn't add to the conversation because I wanted to do a little sit back and watch. It was it was interesting. I was reading them every day, and I was like, oh, this is good. And everybody, like most of the people, the hosts and everything else, as far as tracks and being able, most have more experience than I do being on the track. So it was definitely interesting to see all that come together. But the one thing with the radios that I want to know about, because we'll hear in Formula One, is that don't talk to me in the corners, because it has caused almost crashes and in some cases has led to off tracks. And I gotta figure it's very similar when you're on a motorcycle too. When you're in the corner, that's when you're most vulnerable, right? That is the sketchiest part of your race day. You know, would you want someone to blast into your radio? You're coming into an apex, knee and elbow on the deck, caution, caution, and it's like whoa, 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 like your concentration can get, you know, a little rattled. Then it's one of those things they have to think about, right? I don't really know how much it'll affect. If the riders know it might come, maybe their mental capacity for it's not so bad, but there's definitely a little bit of testing and tweaking before they would ever get this out, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, I definitely think that it can easily be done. I think that if you practice with it and kind of know what it's going to sound like, it's not going to be that distracting. It's kind of like fighter pilots in their jets. They have a lot going on, especially like an F-15. There's no RIO, or I think they're radar intercept officers or whatever, the weapons officer, I think they are called now. If just a pilot, he's got to worry about flying, he's got to worry about his fuel, he's got to worry about what armament he has, what he's doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, especially if he's in a dogfight. And that's why they would take things like they would program a woman's voice to tell them that they were low on fuel, because they want that distraction so that it shouldn't, that's something that shouldn't be there, which means I needed to pay attention to this. So there's going to be those trade-offs about whether we have that or we don't have that. The one thing, I'm all for it if it can be done where it doesn't cause a problem. If it doesn't cause a problem and we can eliminate a Hoffe siren incident again, I am all 100% for it. Where I am going to draw the line with the radios is I don't want the pits talking to the rider at all, period. End of statement. I don't want them saying, hey, you need to switch to map 3. Your tire temperatures are too high. You need to nurse them. Hey, you got to be easier on the brakes because they're getting hot. I don't want any of that, because Formula One does that. I don't want any coaching from the pit wall about what's going on. When you're on that bike, I think it's about you, your motorcycle, what you set up and what your game plan is. And then what game plan you don't have, because as Mike Tyson said famously, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face, which is exactly what happens when you're racing a motorcycle. So I'm all for it on safety grounds, and it's only the FIM or Dorna officials, you know, the race officials saying, hey, this is an emergency. There's a problem on the track. There's something you need to be made aware of. I'm fine with it, but no coaching from the pit lane. Zero.
No, no. We know we do not need the World Engineering Racing Championship.
No. Just, that's Formula One.
No. Yep, exactly. Get all your work done before. Get a game plan. Execute. Period. All right. Well, that brings us to the halfway point, or so we like to think it is, of the podcast. But that brings us into a little bit of qualifying, a little bit of racing. As always, I have missed most of the qualifying. Actually, I didn't see any level of qualifying. I gotta pick and choose on the weekends what I can get in and what I can't. And unfortunately, it seems as of late, GP qualifying doesn't quite make its way in some days. But we'll just kind of buzz through that. Jim has definitely got some highlights and some points to talk about, and then we'll get into the racing.
Sure. So Q1 of Moto3, you had Sasaki, Binder, Arbolino, Anshu, Antonelli, and Fanati are all in that first session. Fanati, Lopez, and Rossi got out of that one, along with Arbolino, who had a great last lap to get in, and it bumped Binder out. So Binder did not make it into the second qualifying session. Well, the second qualifying session was fraught with craziness because McPhee fell early on. He wasn't able to get the bike running again, and so he was going to start way down the list. Agura was on top until Suzuki went to number one, and then Rodrigo led a charge that went to pole, and then it just kept flipping, and you're just like waiting for the last guy, and everybody thought that, hey, this is over and done, and suddenly Agura just showed up with a blistering lap to grab pole position. It was crazy because he was at the end of the train that was trying to get around to get a lap in before time expired, and he made it by about a tenth of a second across the line, and he made it count. So he was going to start from pole. Rodrigo was going to be second, then Suzuki, Minho, Fanati, Fernandez, Vietti, Alcoba, Arbolino, Slat, Garcia, Rossi. Albert Arena is having a much poorer qualifying session than what I thought he should be for that track, his bike, and where he was. I expected him to be in the top 10. I didn't expect him to be 13th. I expected him to be no worse than 10. He's not a great qualifier. He's kind of like Rossi. He doesn't qualify well, but he does race very well. So it was going to be interesting to watch where he was going to come from. And then we had our poor old friend John McPhee was going to start from 17th. And that was really sad for me, and it was something that I wanted to watch because all throughout practice, McPhee had a very strong pace. He was riding a lot of laps by himself without a bunch of people around him. So I was very interested to see what was going to happen with him when they actually got down to the racing.
And as we know, Jim, when it comes to Moto3, how much does qualifying matter?
Zero. But I will say that qualifying doesn't matter, but it matters in the respect that if you are farther back, your chance of something crazy going on and affecting you is much greater. So if there's a first turn incident, if you're in the front two rows, odds are you're going to make it through that incident. If you're somewhere on rows 3, 4, and 5, you have maybe a 60% chance of making it through that carnage because it just depends on what's going to happen. So qualifying is always important. It's just that sometimes it's not as important as it is in other classes. I think it's extremely important now in MotoGP because I think so much of how your race weekend is going to go depends on how you qualify. I don't think it's that way in Moto3 yet, but I do think you need to try to be a little closer to the front to avoid potential problems. Let's go to the actual race. As it started, it was Agura, Suzuki, and then Agura and Suzuki back and forth. Fernandez went down. We had Vietti and Garcia was there. It was kind of a nasty little crash. There was no official, hey, anybody get penalized kind of thing came out of it. It was considered a racing incident. I thought it was a racing incident. We don't have all the camera angles. My thought on it was that, you know, Garcia got in there deep, lost the front, and then he took other people out. And that's racing. And that's kind of what it looked like to me.
So from what I saw on it, and it was hard to tell because the angle that they had when on the bikes wasn't really conclusive. And the angle from above couldn't get you, and they almost told two different stories. Whereas it almost looked like the angle on the bike, Garcia got in there, and he got in there a little hot in the end, and he lost the front end and then clipped the back. What was it, Fernandez's bike? Who did he hit?
Yeah, no, Fernandez was the third guy knocked out. It was Garcia to Vietti, and Vietti knocked down Fernandez because that bump caused him to set up right, and he clipped the back end of Fernandez's bike.
So, okay, so Garcia got in, but then it looks like when he got in, the bike in front of him checked up more than he thought he was going to, because he might have been like the accordion effect, like you get in traffic, right? And then his front tire then clipped, and we all know rear tire versus front tire, that's always going to be a win for the rear. And that's when he lost the bike, and that's when he bumped out and took out the other riders. So, like you said, I think if you have those two incidents and it's inconclusive, then there's only one way to go. Racing yep. incident.
And that's the way they did it. I think it was a good call. These things are going to happen. These guys are too close, too tight. And what happened after that was, only thing I could describe was, it was a bar fight.
I don't know how you take notes in this one. First of all, no position stayed the same for more than three corners, and there was no taking it easy at any point in this race.
No. I literally, this is no joke, I have my notes. I've got the first couple laps kind of getting everybody settled in, and then I've got a bunch of just like arrows and scribbles and stuff trying to figure out who's where, and so I just write bar fight. And then I got down to about lap 13, and I realized, well, now it's a knife fight. You know, and then somewhere on my notes, it says at the very end, it says, oh my God, it became a gunfight, because it just goes crazy.
I stopped taking notes, and I didn't realize I had stopped taking notes until about five to go or so. And I was like, oh, at this point, I'm not even going to bother because I'm paying attention to this. I can't look down because I'm going to miss something. And you would, too. And the end definitely had its fireworks as well.
Very much so. Somewhere along this massive group, you had literally some combination of Rodriguez, Suzuki, Arbolino, and that was kind of who was out front at the beginning. And then you had Ogura kind of slide backwards. So I knew McPhee was probably going to be coming up, so I want to see where he was. By this point in the race, with 20 laps to go, he was 12th. I was looking for where Arenas was at this time. I was like, well, Arenas had already shot himself up to 5th from 13th. He had an excellent start. So I thought, ooh, okay, you know, he's going to – we got – this is kind of going on. You know, then we had Sasaki was down with Lopez at turn 8. And then Agüero was out of the seat. He almost lost the bike. He didn't. It was Rodrigo, Arbolino, Bender, because now he had come from way back doing the typical Darren Bender thing. He went to the front with Masi and Suzuki. McPhee had now showed up at the beginning of it. This is when McPhee got to the front. That's when it became a knife fight. It was elbows out. It was all crazy. Foggia had a track limits warning there. Bender finally went all the way to the front. Rodrigo kind of went back to the front again. He was looking very strong. It seemed like every time Rodrigo got past, he fought back. He didn't lay down. He took him. He went right back at everybody again, which was really interesting to see, to watch. McPhee had went backwards again. He was back to like 13th with 10 laps to go, and then with 9 laps to go, Bender went down, which I think we've seen so many times. We've seen poor Darren go down again. You and I both think this. I agree with you. I think he works the front tire too hard just on his size and the weight that he has. I think he's sort of over the top on the bike. But if he goes to sprint to Petronas, there's every chance that maybe they'll help him correct that or calm it down.
Just a side note, this crash, however, was because he spun up the rear and they got some vicious curbs at Misano that have what do you think? It's about 2 to 3 inch drop off right on the edge of it.
Yeah, I don't know why they do it that way, but that's right. It's dropped off and then he high sided himself and Foggia nipped by with a huge wobble where he kind of just nudged the bike as it went by. He was lucky to be able to stay on that one, and you're right, Bender did lose the rear on the curbs, which was bizarre. So at this point, McPhee had risen all the way up to fifth. Now it's a gunfight because the heavy armor came out now because everybody was just going crazy. It was literally like McPhee had flipped a switch and showed up. Masia was there, Rodrigo was there, Suzuki, McPhee, Arena, Segura, Arbolino. It is the chaos of racing that we love. These guys were changing three or four times a lap. You couldn't really keep it. I mean, I basically have to look at the tree and the pole on the side and see who's where at the four different sectors of the track. And in between there, it was going crazy. Masia was still out front with four to go, followed by Rodrigo. McPhee had been to third. And then it's like we get down to like the very end of this. McPhee had a major front end moment with two laps to go. And then Arenas goes down in a very weird crash. And I've never seen one like this before. It looked like he had literally pitched the little Moto 3 bike in and he was dirt tracking it in there sideways. And the back end just goes out and you can watch it just hop over the bumps and eventually it just caught. And it should have been a high side with as far out as the back was, but Arenas somehow fell off on the low side. So that was like, whoa, major championship moment here because he's down. McPhee's at the front. This is going to get crazy because he had a 25-point lead and Arenas was going to lose 25 points. He was going to lose his lead or, you know, potentially lose a large chunk of it because he only had a 25-point lead. So he really didn't need a DNF, which he now had a DNF. I think he had one earlier this year, but I can't remember.
Spain,
I think he had a DNF. So that's all happening. Like, okay, I'm trying to scribble notes down for that one. And then we get out the run down to turn eight. Literally, they mugged Rodrigo. Everybody mugged that poor kid. I mean, that was a life lesson on how to ride Moto 3 in about 100 feet. Like, they came at him, elbows out, and just muscled that boy around to where he had nowhere to go. And that's when you have to get out and get your own elbows out, and you got to ride rough. And that was when it really was a gunfight then, because we were going for it here. Like, it was – somebody understood that, you know, we've got to go. They had done that. So they came out. They ran to the line. McPhee won the race. Great ride by John. Agüero was second. Then Suzuki, Alcoba, and Rodriguez. I got to get back to the actual end of it. McPhee, Agüero, Suzuki, Alcoba, Rodrigo, Arbolino was in there. Then Masia, Fanati, Faggia, and Migno was the top 10. And an absolutely fantastic Moto 3 race all the way around. Great race. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. It's worth the time.
No, it will keep your attention the whole time. It is probably one of the best, if not the best, weekend race of the weekend for the consistent action that went on through. But John McPhee, we said this before earlier in the year, that there's one thing we've noticed from him that he's improved upon, and that's his racecraft. His overall lap speed, he may not get to put in that flyer from he's had some poor qualifying, but he makes his way to the front every Sunday. And had he not had that one crash there in Jerez, I think he'd be a little bit further up in the championship. Maybe
he had the one in Austria too.
Oh yeah, because then he'd probably be heading the championship after this. But he is definitely someone that's probably going to be stepping up here soon. He's got the thing where now he knows how to win, and there's a difference between being fast and knowing how to win. And he's got that now. He's got that, and it was an impressive race. He knew when to pull it because, like you said, around about lap before Arenas crash, I think it was about between that like lap 8 to lap 11 area, or maybe a little bit closer down to 7-6. But when McPhee got out and got to the front, the pace picked up, and that's when the field really, because that's championship contenders. Before that, when it's the other guys a little bit lower, Arenas is okay with sitting in fifth. But as soon as somebody who's right there in the championship, where like Agüero's out there or McPhee's out there, boom, that pace is going up. And McPhee, once he hit the front, he knew he did not want to be part of that mess back there. And you can just ask Rodrigo about that, about being in the back. And you do not want to be duking it out around about fifth, because you can go from two corners and go ask the Leopard boys, who were up in second and third, ended up finishing out there as far back as ninth. So, yeah. To the front you go, to the front you stay, and that's how you win.
That's right. It's, you have to consistently finish on that podium if you want to win championships or be sniffing at it. But in the championship, Arenas leads on 106. Agura now is only 5 points behind on 101. McPhee jumped himself up to 92. If he'd have one of those crashes back, he would be leading the points. So, and then Suzuki, Arbolino, Vietti, Rodrigo, Fernandez, Masi, and Foggia round out the top 10. What's interesting in Moto3 is it's so up and down about who's on top and who isn't. Foggia has looked so good for the past couple weekends, yet he's nowhere this weekend. He's well down the list.
Well, he was there.
Yeah, but he was only
there. But he got blasted out with like on the last lap. He was part of that whole bashing up with
exactly,
Rodrigo.
That's,
I mean, he was running up to the front.
It's like, that's the thing. that's where it was a gunfight. Like, look, these guys are coming. These are the fastest guys, and they're the guys that are, you know, Arenas, McPhee, and Ogura, and I guess Suzuki too. Those are the three guys who are the best of the class, or four guys, sorry. They're the best of the class. When those guys are coming, they're coming hard. Like, they play the game for real, right? You know, it's like the meme says, you know, when it's time to fight, you'll know it. And you need to fight like you're the third monkey trying to get on the Noah's Ark, and it's starting to rain. I mean, that's how hard you have to fight in Moto 3 to stay at the front. And that's what these guys have to learn. That's what, you know, Arbolino is only 19. He's got to learn that. You know, Rodrigo's a teenager. He has to learn that too. These are the guys that are going to be the next generation that are going to be coming, but they need a little more seasoning, a little bit more time in the class to understand there's a difference. I mean, I follow hockey. You like sports and stick and ball stuff too, Tyler. I know. So it's like there's always this thing where you have to learn how to be a pro, right? You got to learn how to bring your game every single night, whether it's pitching or you're batting or playing hockey. And that's what these guys are trying to learn is bring what you do best every single time you hit the track. And it takes a little bit to get there.
It does.
No shame in that.
No. And I mean, especially in the Moto 3, this is where you need to be crafting all of that and putting that together. And you get to Moto 2, and that's when the outright speed gets through. So then you couple your outright speed with your racecraft in Moto 2. You put that all together. You get to MotoGP, and you put your balls out on the table because that's what you're really going to need up there. But
oh, yeah. You need a couple big cajones to be able to do it, right? I mean, that's how it goes.
Right.
You got anything else for Moto 3?
Nah. I'm ready to jump over to Moto 2.
All right. Moto 2 qualifying. In the first qualifying session was Roberts, DiGiantonio, Canet, Chantra, and Baldassari. They were in. Basically, Roberts fell down at turn 14. He was in a position to actually go through. He had several minutes left on the clock. I didn't write down the time that was left for him, but he was hoping he was going to make it in. As it turned out, it was DiGiantonio, Remy Gardner, who threw down an incredible lap right at the end actually to get in, then Roberts and then Ramirez were all going through to the main qualifying session, QP2. QP2 was the Sam Lowe's show, because he just threw down a wicked lap to break the track record and be on pole. Bezzecchi fell off. Marini went to second, but they took it away. Remy Gardner had jumped up at the very end to second, and then he was like from nowhere because he wasn't even being talked about, and he jumped up right there at the end to run to go second, and then Lowe's still hung on to the pole position. Now, it finished off from qualifying as Lowe's, Gardner, Marini, Bezzecchi, Bastianini, Vierge, Schroeder, Fernandez, Nakashima, and DiGiantonio. That was the top 10. However, everybody was going to get bumped one position up because Lowe's was going to have to start from the pit lane because he had to pay for that that loss of concentration moment when he caused that crash in Austria 2 weeks prior.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then that goes into the morning warm-up when Remy fell, fractures a hand in his foot. He's declared unfit to ride, and everybody bumped up again. So Marini was actually on pole with Bezzecchi second and Bastianini third. So it was an all-Italian front row in the race for Moto2.
At Misano.
At Misano, which makes it even better, right? So all-Italians on the front row in Misano.
You got two of the VR46 riders in there, which I'm pretty sure they're, I don't think they're that far from Misano. They've trained there quite a bit, like on the R6s and whatnot. Yep. So, I mean, the stars were aligning for them.
the stars were aligning. As mentioned, Gardner had crashed in the warm-up. Lowe's was coming out of the pit lane. One thing about this start, they came from the warm-up lap, got everybody together, and boom, that light was quick. I don't know if you're watching, if you pay attention to the lights and how quick they go. That one was a quick light. Like, I thought for sure they were going to catch somebody napping on that one because that went by, like, in a heartbeat. But it was Marini, Bezzecchi, Schroeder shot up to the front, then Bastianini, Vierge, Luthi, as we started out. Marini and Bezzecchi were starting to get away a little bit. Schroeder was holding up Bastianini, so Bastianini had to get by. The two out front had about a second gap, and Schroeder was definitely, he was a holdup. There was no way it was there. Bastianini had to get by. He had no choice because they were going to be gone if he didn't. So he finally muscled his way past Schroeder, which I thought that took him, I don't know, probably maybe two or three laps too long, in my opinion, to get to where he was to get by. But, that's racing. It's a tight track, and if you're riding defensively, you can hold somebody up at Misano because there's not, despite the fact that you think that it looks like, well, there's a lot of turns and there's a lot of outbreaking each other, we should be able to do this. It's the fact that the track turns back on itself, which gives you the ability to run around the outside, and consequently now you're on the inside for the next turn. So a lot of give and take in that respect of it. Hector Garzo was down. Then we had 18 laps to go, and Bastianini had a good place going. But he was like 1.8 seconds down. So the other guys were like about almost two seconds ahead. And it was like, okay, he's got pace, but I don't know what's going to happen. And then it's right in this middle section of the race, it gets boring. It's just Bastianini or Marini's just out front.
There is a lull for sure.
And I'm actually writing this stuff down in my notes, and I'm thinking, what could we do to spice up Moto 2? Because this used to be, as Jim Race famously coined, the axe murderer class. Like, this thing was crazy when it first started, right? People were going bonkers nuts and everything. And I'm like, I want some of that racing back because I just came from watching this incredibly awesome Moto 3 race. And I'm like, well, I want some of that Moto 3 action here. And I'm like, well, why can't I get it? Because it's basically a KLX Cup with Triumph engines. So we should have everybody together, but we never seem to anymore. And it's really weird. And just when I finally get through that point of it, and I'm writing these notes down, like, going to ask you, hey, Skyler, how do we fix this class? Whoa, wait a second. Things got interesting. Things start changing. All of a sudden, I'm like, whoa, Marini had a 1.2 second lead over Bezzecchi, and then Bezzecchi had about a second over Bastianini, and suddenly, poof, it's like, whoa, it's 7/10, because suddenly here comes, Bezzecchi finally came to life, right? But it was Bastianini who was really chipping things away. It was just a little bit by little bit by little bit by little bit, and Bastianini was really getting close, but then he made a big mistake at turn 8, where he wound up basically saving it a la Marc Marquez. So I'm going to just tuck the front end, and I'm going to ride it out on the old elbow and pop her up here at the end and race on.
Wow, that was – you couldn't tell me Marquez hadn't jumped in some blue leathers on the weekend. It looked identical to the way he saves the bike.
Yes, completely. So that was sort of the – I wrote that was the end of Bastianini's charge because he was charging, he was closing, it was going to get there. Then Marini – has his own problem. He literally caught a false neutral, which I'm not blaming Triumph here, people, and get very clear. There have been quite a few false neutrals in those gearboxes. I read some articles where they know that there are certain riders who are a whole hell of a lot harder on that gearbox than other riders. They won't name names, but I'm wondering maybe Marini uses that gearbox a little bit harder than some of the others because he found that false neutral. He saved it. He got back in front, but now Bezzecchi was right there with him. So it's like race on with about eight laps to go. And then Marini and Bezzecchi trade places, and it sort of becomes a good scrap. I mean, they're going back, forth, and we get a bunch of lead swapping. But now Bastianini's in the window. Like, he's in the frame, right? He can see what's going on, and he's right there. Like, I thought his race was over, and suddenly he shows right back up again, because when these two guys started swapping and taking away the good lines from each other, they started slowing down. I mean, they were running a good 3/10 to 4/10 of a second a lap slower than what Bastianini was running. I'm like, oh man, this is gonna be it. We're in for a barn burner here right at the end. You know, good thing I stayed awake. And I was like, oh man, you know. But then Bezzecchi has an error at turn 14. Marini's gone, and so you wind up with Marini winning the race. Bezzecchi comes home second. Bastianini's third. Then, you know, the people we didn't talk about, Verhey, Fernandez, Luthi, DG Antonio. Sam Lowe's had a great ride from dead last out of the pit lane all the way through to an eighth place. I mean, that's an incredible ride, and he needs an attaboy from me for that, which was really good. Aaron Canet had a decent ride to finish ninth. Joe Roberts was in the top 10. Pretty good. Roberts has got to figure out the consistency part of this, because he is really good some weekends, and some weekends he is not even close. And
I think you already talked about it earlier. He's got to learn how to be that pro.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's yeah, you got to bring it every day. And quite honestly, that's, you know, besides lack of talent, I couldn't bring it every day. So that was my whole problem in my world.
Yeah, I mean, I just missed the pros, you know. I need about a foot in height and about, I don't know, 30 pounds of muscle. I've probably been okay, but, you know. Anyway, what are you going to do?
So that was the Moto2 race. I mean, it looked like it was going to be just a snooze fest, but it turned out to being a really good race. You got to kind of go through the lull there in the middle, but, hey, sometimes it's the calm before the storm that gets you caught out, and, you know, that was what happened. So it was definitely good racing. The championship kind of hotted up a little bit. Marini is now on 112. Bastianini's on 95. Bezzecchi's on 85. Martin has now stayed put at 79, but that dropped him to fourth when he was second before. So with Martin missing one race, we need to get Martin back, because he's going to throw some excitement back in this, which I think is really going to be cool, because now he's got something to fight for. You know, hey, I don't know if Martin really wants to win this world championship. Does it really matter? Because who was the last Moto2 world champion who's done anything really exciting and special in MotoGP?
Mark Marquez?
That's what I was thinking. That was where my vote was, because I was thinking, well, Zarco didn't really do much of anything.
No.
Luthi was a champion, right? 1 year, I think.
It's so hard, because he's been there so long.
Where's Harry Lloyd when you need him? Right,
for real, or anybody that keeps track of this stuff.
Right, but it's almost like Moto2 is like a little curse. Like, whoever wins a Moto2 World Championship is cursed.
Right, because Alex Marquez, you know,
right? Because as far as I know, it was the last guy to win a Moto2 Championship and then be successful in MotoGP. You know, win races is Marquez.
Oh wait, well,
Zarco, I guess.
Well,
right.
Well,
what am I missing? Well,
we can't talk about it because it's spoilers, Jim.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. Sorry, I missed that one. I forgot about that. I should have. But, yeah.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
But I'm right. Right? I mean,
yes,
you get where I'm coming from.
It's not the jump that you'd expect to see.
Right. It's not, yeah. It used to be, you saw a guy come and win a Moto3 title. They progressed. They won a Moto2 title, i.e. Rossi, right? Rossi won a 125 title. He won a 250 title. He won 500 title. He won a MotoGP title.
Well, here's the thing, right? Let's think about Moto2. Moto2 was in 2009, right? Marquez won that championship in 2012. So only 3 years in existence, he won it, and now he's a multi-time world champ. Let's look at MotoGP and outright. How many guys are there for Moto2 versus how many of these guys? Now, if you say the same thing, how many 250 champions are in MotoGP? Well, okay, it's a little different, right? So the intermediate class does pump up, you know, ventures. But the thing is, when you're really good in GP, you tend to stick around for a while. So I don't think Moto2's been around long enough to have a sample size to decide if that format works. Because we have probably one of the greatest, if not, we'll go down as the greatest champions of all time, came from Moto2. But, I mean, for God's sake, I think that guy on any bike coming up through the ranks would have been where he's at now. Have we not seen a lot of success out of Moto2? Well, yes and no. I mean, Paul Espargaró was Moto2, you know.
Mir comes to mind. I mean, he didn't have that success at that great of a Moto2 single season, but he went Moto3 champion to Moto2 to boom, MotoGP.
Yep, Mir. I mean, Quartararo wasn't that great at Moto2. He jumped over. But
yep.
There's...
Well, Quartararo wasn't good in Moto3 either.
No. The thing about Moto2 was that with Mir is that he was making his way towards the front, and he just only spent a year there because Suzuki was like, if we don't get him now, someone's going to get him later. So I think given him another year, he'd have been boom right up there, because it took him half a season. He was already to the front. So
it just seems like it's an odd class. Like, some people, it's weird. Some people stagnate there and spend the rest of their career riding that class.
Well, nothing. Some people do that Moto3 too. I mean, well, yeah. There's a glass ceiling for some people.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't know what it is. It just seems like this is just a really weird class. Like there's something missing, and I don't know what it is.
Yeah. I mean, if you ever want to look at a champion that holds down a class forever, and then when he goes up to the next level or even makes a lateral move, can't do anything, look at Keenan Sofuagoglu.
Yeah.
Right? World Superboard champ. No one can touch that guy on a Supersport bike. Very few can. Maybe a little Laverty, a little Crutchlow during his heyday, right?
Yeah.
But for the most part, you're not messing with him. But he goes a Superbike, and he doesn't know his ass from an elbow, right? As Colin Edwards would say.
He didn't look good in Moto2, and you would have thought for sure no. He would have completely
All
ran that
class.
All he
did in Moto2 was
ragged.
Burn up his tires within the first five laps, and to the back he went, right? Because mm-hmm. You couldn't ride the bike similar.
Yeah.
So... It's, I think, the most important job Moto2, and if it doesn't do this well enough, they need to do it now. It has to give you the ability to ride a MotoGP bike, right? They need to be built so that style that you pick up in Moto2 can translate over to a GP bike. Because a guy from World Supersport can't make that jump to MotoGP because the bikes are very different. But Moto3 to Moto2, perhaps because, you know, stiffer frames, custom frames, similar motors, you know, all of that, right? You can make that jump. So I think it's not as exciting as it once was, like we're used to. And Moto3 might be a false racing, because why it's so much closer is because the talent pool there is about who can make their way to the front, when everybody who's in Moto2 has already made their way to the front. So it's that much harder to get there. And it's the same reason we don't have Moto3 racing in MotoGP, because everybody there, given a good bike, can probably win a race, just about. So as you work your way towards that front, I think it's just, you're going to get separation in each class just because the talent is so good, but it's also spread out a little bit further in the classes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, all extremely valid points that make damn good sense. But yeah, I send me hate mail. I don't care. There's something odd. I'm not sure what it is yet. Give me time. I might figure it out.
There'll be a pinpoint. Oh, well, you know, yep. So much for that halfway through the podcast. We haven't even got to GP yet, and we're already at 102.
Are you? Oh, man. All right, let's do this quick. Let's do MotoGP quick. All right. I'll do the qualifying. You run the race. How's that? Okay, so MotoGP first round qualifying: Paul Espargaró, Nakagami, Binder, Oliveira, and Lecuona. Yeah, every KTM is in the first session. Not a good weekend for KTM at all. Cal wasn't riding because he had the fluid problem because of the arm pump surgery and the fluid retention. That wasn't good. Basically, you had Paul Espargaró, who went through to get into the second session. Oliveira jumped up to second. So those two were going through. So two KTMs got out of there by the skin of their teeth, basically. And then we get into QP2. QP2 was interesting because Pol tucks the front on his first run. He was down at 15. There's like no front end grip on the KTMs. They couldn't get it to turn. Come to find out later that they were having lots of trouble in there. Quartararo was leading at the first run. Rossi was right there. The Yamahas on a track that we expected them to look good at. They've won a lot of poles there. They haven't won races, but the Yamahas were looking great. Followed by Morbidelli, Bagnaia with the first V4, Vinales, and Miller. We go to the second runs, and then Vinales goes to pole. Then Mir comes across, is all kinds of crossed up into turn four. Vinales, he then swaps bikes very quickly because Vinales went to pole. He was out by himself. Everybody was kind of in, changing tires, waiting, getting ready to come back out again. He did the bike swap system like Marquez had pioneered long ago and went right back out on his second bike and made sure that he was going to be there. Now, in the meantime, Morbidelli had went to pole. Vinales, you're thinking, was going to wind up with a last lap attack, and he did, to put himself back on pole. So the front row was Vinales, Morbidelli, Quartararo, all the Yamahas, and the least fast of all the Yamahas was Valentino Rossi. Then you had, after that, Jack Miller being the first of the V4s, Bagnaia, then Rins, and Mir. Now the Suzukis were 7 and 8 on the grid. I expected more out of the Suzukis considering they have an inline four just like the Yamaha. We know that those bikes are really fast in transition, but maybe they were having a little more problems dealing with the bumps. Wasn't sure why they were there. I thought both of them should have been top five, at least 5-6 somewhere in there. Dovizioso having a miserable time in qualified in ninth, then Zarco, Espargaro, and Oliveira. And I don't think Oliveira actually went out in that session. I think he stayed pat, and I don't think they had enough new tires, so I think he may have stayed in the pits. So that it brings us, ends up qualifying and takes us to the race.
All right, so from qualifying, like we saw, it was the first time in history that the first four spots in the race were taken up by Yamahas. So that was pretty impressive. And we know Yamaha has been working on their whole shot device. However, it has had some inconsistencies with the riders. What that inconsistency's been, don't know. Don't know if it's the mechanical side, the rider side, the electronic side, who knows. But we get to the start and we see there's a direct 50-50 Maverick and Quartararo. They go backwards, and then Morbidelli gets the best hole shot, followed by Rossi, who's there, right on bottom. So Master and Apprentice are off to the start, and they're off and going. And then, of course, the person who's been picking up the most pieces and has always been at the front ready for some action has been Jack Miller. And I'm going to take a second right here because, well, maybe we'll get to the end. And I want to talk about Miller a little bit more with you a little bit later on, Jim.
Sounds good. Let me interject a couple of things to start with this. One, Vinales' bike was smoking badly when he brought it back after the siding lap to the grid. Now, that had to have been playing on his mind because there was a back and a forth, and then the crew kind of went at it and looked at it. I don't know if they overfilled an oil reservoir or maybe there was some leaking antifreeze or water out of the radiator. They don't run antifreeze. I know that, people. I misspoke. Maybe that was some steam that we were seeing. Whatever it was, I think that put Vinales off of his game. He's very much all about what's in his head. And then the other thing, too, you have to understand is Vinales went with a hard rear tire, and Rossi swapped at the last second to a medium rear, which is what predominantly most people were running.
And as a matter of fact, Vinales was the only one, I think, on the hard rear. So, but he has said that was what he felt most comfortable on, and that's what he set his lap times with in the rest of the weekend. So, I mean, I guess you can't really fault the guy for going with that tire. But one of the things that you do have to pay attention to when you run hard tires is very finicky weather changes. So weather was a little bit different on race day than it had been all weekend. So definitely played to the – are we going to call – are we going to give it a name? Is it called the Maverick Fall, the Maverick Slide? What do you think we should call it when the Maverick starts to race and he goes back to seventh for some reason?
How about the Maverick Muck-Up?
All right. We can run with that. All right. So one thing we noticed that, like you had mentioned, the bumps on the track and the head shake, and it was really scary for the first couple laps. Is these guys were on a little bit colder tires, and then the first time, I think, what is it? Was it 11, 12, 13 back there, the really fast right-handers?
Yeah. 11's the fast one, and then it gets – yeah, it was scary. Plus, they got full tanks. There's full tanks of fuel, too. So it was – yeah, it was brutal.
Full lean at 150 miles an hour or more, and that bike is wobbling. Oh man, I don't know, they all hung on to it, but geez, that's a sketchy part. But we get to that part, and I had put in this point, I said watch for a low side, it's in my notes. So right after passing Vinales, Fabio Quartararo gets by him because Rossi and Morbidelli are starting to get away. Quartararo is like, I gotta go get me some of that. I've been setting the fastest laps consistently all week. I can win this. I need to get my championship back on track. He gets past Vinales and low side. Down he goes. And with him went the championship lead for sure. You're thinking at this time, it's like, all right, well, there's a note. It says, flashback, Skyler Jim, Jerez. Quartararo's got to be like a shoo-in for the championship at this point. Ooh, maybe I'll edit this and put it a womp, 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 womp. Or just a, you know, something like that. This is why we are not experts, folks. We got to stop guessing after. We got
everybody
way
did.
Too...
Everybody did. Everybody was engraving Quartararo's name on this because he was the heir apparent to the throne. The man himself was missing, and therefore he won two races. Oh, whoa, we got this. Yeah, well, you know, racing at the front and leading a championship are different. It's called being a professional, I think.
Yes. I think there's a title coming for this podcast. But he goes down, and it's not looking good for him. So by this time, though, Rins had gotten past Vinales, and the Suzukis are starting to make their way to the front. Rins looking good. That front end on the Suzuki is fantastic. They can put it pretty much anywhere they want when they want it. Morbidelli at this point had started to pull just the slightest gap over Rossi, and he was consistently throwing down the same lap times, wasn't losing any speed. But there was one person kind of in the back that was looking really fast, and that was Pecco Bagnaia. Remember, Pecco is still coming off of a busted leg, and he has to walk around with a crutch, and he has to use a crutch to get on his bike, so he doesn't have his full strength. But I tell you one thing he's still got his full commitment, because, man, he was throwing that bike into corners. And once his tires got the temp and he burned off just a little bit of fuel, that bike really came good to him, and he was on his way. He was on his way with Rins, and they were making their way to the front. And along with them was Rins' teammate, Mir. They all looked sharp. At this point, Fabio Quartararo had pulled in on lap 19 after being some like 20 seconds out the back. Swaps out bikes and then crashes again. It's time to call it a day at that point. And I know you got to be back next weekend, but oof, man, his head has to be all kinds of topsy-turvy at the moment after having such a bad day. But at this point, Pecco Bagnaia, who was chasing down Rossi, gets by it, and now Rossi's got to sit back and go, you know, I'm watching the kids I trained pass me. Was this a great idea? And he's probably thinking, yes, look at my work. Look at it. My coaching is a shining example. The Italians are back to the front. We're 1, 2, 3. This is what I envisioned this whole time I started this camp some 5, 6, 7 years ago, whenever it is that he got the Rossi 46 Academy going. But then, so we lost Tito Rabat out the back. We kind of forgot he's been in GP this year anyway, so that's okay. And the battle for second at this point was looking really, really good. We had Morbidelli already kind of checked out, but Bagnaia, Rossi, Rins, Mir, they're all together. That whole pack is covered by less than 2 seconds, and all of these guys have a different part of the track which they are fast on. And then we see Bagnaia. He is kind of in the rows. Mir has an incredible move as he's coming in to catch up to Rossi, and they're just kind of looking around and the jostling position. Finally, we get to the end. Morbidelli gets his first win in dominant fashion, and it was probably, and this is the fourth first time winner of the season. I remember I'm getting a lot of 2016 vibes from this year where it's just going to be who knows, you know, who's going to get the win. But he brings it home first, and followed by a very strong performance on his return with Pekka Bagnaia. Juan Mir, like I said, he made an impressive move on Rossi in the last lap there to grab and snatch up third place. Rossi was definitely not happy about getting off the podium because he wanted to be there to celebrate with his boys. Alex Rins, he lost a little bit there towards the end, kind of had to fall off the back, finished in fifth. Matt Vinales, he fell to sixth, stayed in sixth, and that's where he rid the whole race. Andrea Dovizioso, he just rode his way to seventh. He just stayed on the track and didn't let anybody really pass him. I said, you know, and then Jack Miller, he must have had tires fall off because he went flying backwards, unfortunately. But Dovizioso, with that seventh place, takes the championship lead. And I think that's like Dovizioso's like third or fourth race this year. He's been in the top 10, but below top 5. And he's leading the championship. Go figure. What a strange year. Right there, Taka Nakagami bringing it home for Honda. Honda, it was not gelling well with this track, so ninth is probably, let's go ahead and take it, in front of Paul Espargaró, who grabbed that Red Bull by the horns and pulled it on up there, and he finished right in front of Oliveira, Binder, Espargaró, Lecuona, and Zarco running out there through the back. Now, before we get to the championship, what I wanted to talk about was Jack Miller. Jack Miller had, one crash this year, I think? Right. So with that crash, though, had he had not had that crash, he'd be damn near the lead. But I want to say what's been different about Miller this year, there's been some tire burn-ups, but he's been at the front on Saturday, and he's been at the front on Sundays, and he's kind of learned how to control his pace. His craft and his bike and his skill are all coming together perfectly. I think Ducati made the bright move in putting him on the factory bike. And I don't know if he's going to beat a full power, full strength Marquez, but he's going to give it his damnedest. And I'm really pinning him to be the guy to watch next year.
You make valid points. The thing in this race is that Miller went with the soft tire, which is what the crew kind of advised him with. He felt like he should have went with his gut and gone with a medium. Matt Oxley talks about this in his article, but I kind of had suspected this, and sort of Matt kind of confirmed it. Miller adapts to what he has and gets the best out of what is there, a la Marc Marquez. This season smacks of 2000 to me, because Mick Doohan was done. He had broken his arm, shoulder, had the nerve problem, wasn't racing. No one knew what to do because the leader who set the pace and everybody followed was not there. And Kenny Roberts Jr. wins a championship through consistency. So this is what I'm seeing here. The King's got a problem. He's not there. Marquez is on the side. So no one knows what to do to win races and run at the front, be consistent, that kind of thing. But Miller is like Marquez. He simply understands the bike in some weird fashion that you and I can't understand, but can only dream of being able to understand, because then we would be racing. And he just adapts and does it and has a feel, and it's not quite the same thing that Marquez has, but it's damn close. It's a lot like what Stoner had, and that's kind of what's going on. He's just riding to suit the conditions and the bike and what's there, which really seems to be the key point. There seems to be something really weird with how the Moto2 guys put down rubber on that track that the Michelins don't like. And so they have to sort of scrub it off or scrub it clean, or there isn't as much grip to begin with, and then it becomes good. That's a lot of what happens to Vinales. He's like, well, I don't have grip. I don't have anything until the track rubbers in anywhere between 5 to 10 laps. Well, that's a third of the race gone. You're not going to make up all of what you have thrown away because you're not able to ride the bike how you want to. You have to ride the bike like it needs to be ridden. And that's a big difference. And that is what Miller does well. It's kind of what Brad Binder does to a certain extent. It's definitely what Marquez does. But the guys who are going to be the fast guys, like on in next year, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with Marquez, Binder, and Miller. I think those guys could be really crazy at the front. because of how they ride and how they do it by feel. And that's everything. And there's where the speed is. That's how these guys are speed. Benyaya, that's going to be interesting to look at too, because Benyaya rides that Ducati in a completely different way than the way Miller rides or the way Andrea Dovizioso rides. And I'm not sure how he really does it, but he doesn't have a reference point. He came from a Moto2 bike, and now he has this bike, and he's like, well, okay, this works.
Right, so the wheels come off, and then we'll see how it goes. You're right, though, but his riding, it shades a bit of Marquez, where it's like, are you crashing in every corner, or are you in control? I can't tell.
It's close.
Yeah.
It's close. I think it's more down the line of more riding into the corner than crashing into the corner a la Marquez. But everybody's got a different style. I mean, Paul Espargaró on the KTM uses the rear brake so much that they joke and call it his extra foot peg. And the other thing that's really changing all of this is the rear Michelin. The rear Michelin is way more grippy than it was last year because they've got a little softer construction. So the sidewall flexes more, which squats the tire, squishes it into the pavement, if you will, and makes a wider contact patch. Well, that's great for the inline fours because if that engine and having the crank, having a much more greater crank mass, once you set it somewhere, it's going to stay there because of the inertia versus the lighter one that comes with the V4, et cetera, all that. And it's just, that's one of the things KTM figured out, is they figured out how to make that tire work with the V4. That's why they've had such success. Now, whether they can maintain that and get something back, don't know. But from testing, we know that Rossi thinks he's found something. Yamaha thinks they've found something. They're giving engines back to Quartararo, so he's got motors back. So the rest of this season is going to be pretty crazy. You're going to end at Portimao, which is going to put the cat amongst the pigeons because no one's raced there, and that's just where it's going to get really wonky. And that's kind of where some people are a little worried, Yamaha's worried about the last three rounds. What are they going to do there? What are they going to do at Valencia and at Portimao? We've seen
Don't worry. Marquez will be back.
If that kid comes back and you put him into this mix, oh my gosh. People are going to lose their minds on this one. But it's exciting. I mean, this race was another exciting race. I mean, we're seeing cracks in Quartararo that I didn't think were there. I thought the kid was mentally tougher than this. Not so much, I guess,
Yeah. I mean, we're going to find out, right? We've got 8 races to go. Still, that's a lot of racing. That's a lot of points. I mean, he might go out and snatch the next 4. We don't know. He's got France coming up. That's going to juice him up a little bit. The Yamahas tend to go well at Le Mans, and we're really going to see where he's at. Now is the time, right? You had the championship, you lost it, you're still in the hunt. Can you rebound? He might come out in Misano, and he fixes this, and he gets the win next weekend, and everybody else goes backwards, and it's right back to where it was. This year, we cannot call the race until a checker flag drops on the 24th of November, 22nd of November. That's when we can go ahead and say, all right, this is how it's going to be. This is how it was. So, all right, let's get through this championship and get the heck out of here. I said I was supposed to be done at 6:30. It's almost 7. I'm pretty sure there's some angry eyes waiting for me somewhere. So let's go ahead. I think she's actually watching the new Mulan, so I think she's okay. All right, so that brings it. Andrea Dovizioso has now taken the championship lead on 76 points, only 6 points back. Fabio Quartararo after his spill, so he's still on the hunt. Jack Miller on 64, he's still in the fight. Joan Mir, with his strong performance in the last couple of races, moved himself into the fourth on 60 points. He's still in the fight. Marat Vinales, he's 58 points. He's not really all the way in the fight, but it's still there. It only takes one good race weekend and everybody else to kind of slip on, and we've seen that plenty of times. 58 points. He's tied with his teammate, Valentino Rossi, on 58 points. Franco Morbidelli, with his win, brings him up to 7th on 57. Brad Binder, he's on 53. Taka Nakagami, 53. Miguel Oliveira, 48. There is nothing here, folks. I mean, this is... Miguel Oliveira can win the championship. Yeah. Anybody... Yeah, there's nothing in it. This is this closest. I said something that this is the, what was it, the least amount of points the championship leader has had over this many races. I think they said in the last 10 years or something like that.
Literally all over the place. I mean, anyone who counts John Mayer, counts Mir out for a championship run is sadly mistaken. You have the great possibility of it being a 5 or 6 rider fight all the way to the end.
And a 4 to 5 manufacturer battle as well.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be a season long remembered.
Yes.
It's not going to fizzle like 2000. Right? 2000
no,
fizzled.
No.
There at the end. It just fizzled out and that was that. But this is going to be crazy the whole rest of the way.
Yep. Across all three categories. Team championship, rider championship, and constructor championship are all
classes too.
Yep.
We're blessed to be watching this because it is amazing what this championship has done this year. It is unprecedented to have this many different riders win on this many different types of machines, and man, you know, it's crazy. I mean, if you are greater than 51 points, you are one race win away from leading the championship. And so basically, that's everybody down to ninth. That's crazy. Buckle up, people, because what, we still got 8 races to go in 11 weeks.
And we're going to a track we've never been to finish it out at a time of the year we don't normally race. So let's just...
What happens if it rains these last 3 weekends?
Let's not talk about that. We don't want that. We want racing. We don't want tiptoeing, especially on a new track.
Well, that's part of it, though. Think about a championship that it's raining at Puerto Mayo, and you got these guys trying to figure out... It comes down to a winner-take-all shootout. I'm all in on that.
I'd rather not. I hate rain races, to be honest.
Oh, come on.
I love seeing fast things go fast. If I want to see things go slow in the rain, I'll go stand by the freeway.
Things go by slow on the freeway at your place regardless of whether it's raining or not.
Oh, no. I got 280 over here, dude. It's 85 miles an hour in the slow lane.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yeah, dude. We got some... Yeah, if 101, you want to go sit in traffic. But 280 out here during most of the week, especially now, I mean, yeah, wow. It's 85 slash lane. They'll slam in triple digits out there quite often.
Okay. I'll take that back.
But yeah.
All right, let's wrap this up. We have gone on. You got angry eyes.
Yes, we have.
I want to go to bed. Sure, I got to leave early in the morning and start traveling for work. So.
All right. So that brings us down to, we're going to close out our show here, folks. Remember, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. It goes to all of the hosts. Sometimes you get a response to us. Sometimes we'll put it right on the show. We have a Facebook page. That's facebook.com/motopod. That's a motopod fan page. And we are on Twitter @moto_pod. You can follow us there for any news, announcements, motorcycle banter. I am also on Twitter @SkylarV28. And I'm also on Instagram @SkylarV28 as well. Jim, where can people find you?
Instagram and Twitter @MotoRGV.
All right. Well, that was a show, Jim. I came into this, I was like, man, are we going to have enough to talk about? And then I was like, wait, we should probably not try to talk about so much. And then, because we want to try to keep this together. And, well, I should know better. I really should.
It's okay. Everybody's in for this one.
That's right. It's good. Our podcast was like the race. It was frantic. It was all over the place. It was a mess. And at the end, it was a lot of fun.
Very much so.
All right, Jeff. Everybody else, take it easy. Soon.
Thank you.